So hello again. Rodney tells me it's going to be warm and sunny starting tomorrow. For many days. Whereas I'm going back to the East Coast tomorrow, where there are ice storms and snowstorms and such things. Can we make that sound go away?
No.
Okay. All right. Just thought I'd ask. The air conditioning went away. Actually,
I can make it a little better.
You can? How? That was a lot better. You made it a lot better.
For a while.
Okay. This story just came to my mind about this time when we had first opened our center in Massachusetts, the Insight Meditation Society, and we decided we wanted to invite, there's a little clinic in downtown Barrie, and we wanted to invite the staff of the clinic up to lunch to get to know us and a little bit about us and what we were trying to do there. And so they came up, and somehow the conversation turned to how incredibly hot it is in certain seasons in India. And one of the people there had been with us in India when we were there for our practice. And she said, oh yeah, there was one excruciatingly hot period when she was in New Delhi, and it was maybe 120 degrees, and she was going from government office to government office trying to renew her visa. And she was especially suffering from the heat because she was very weak. She was suffering from amoebic dysentery, hepatitis, and worms. And one of the doctors from the clinic said, you had amoebic dysentery, hepatitis, and worms, and you were trying to renew your visa? He said, what were you doing, holding out for leprosy? You know, and of course, it seemed like absolutely bizarre when you think about it, but there was something about that time in our lives when, not only were we younger, but there was something so amazing happening in the sense of discovery and finding out who we were on whole other levels than what we've been taught, the ways we've been taught to see ourselves, the ways we had just had certain assumptions about ourselves. And there was something so magical about that kind of discovery about ourselves, about the world, about love, about power of the mind. It was an amazing time, and somehow the heat and the discomfort and the disease and all of that were, although not inconsiderable, they were not defining the situation. They were not defining the time for us. It was something we had to deal with. What really, I think, defined the time for us was that amazing sense of depth, of adventure, of discovery. And now, looking back, I think, boy, it really gave us all a kind of strength and courage that was amazing. You know, in describing our times of practice in Asia, often the things we can describe are the heat and the noise and the bugs and the food and the sickness. And the things we can't describe are the things that really kept us there. Things we can't describe so readily. So often, you know, we tell these stories about practicing in India or Burma or someplace like that, and the people hearing them will say, why? Like, why? But there's that quality within that is amazing. When we can tap into it, that allows us not to be defined by the circumstances we find ourselves in, not to face what is happening with a kind of preordained sense of limitation, as though we can't deal with it, we can't see it through. There are tremendous strengths inside. We reach them sometimes in that kind of adventure, that kind of travel. We reach them in times of great adversity. We reach them in times of community, when we can really let ourselves help one another and be helped by one another. There are many times, many conditions when that's the place we touch inside. When I was working on the last book that I wrote on faith, I would call that faith. That's what I would call faith, is that reaching for and that finding of those kind of inner strengths. Now that I'm not writing the book anymore, of course I'm not so I don't have such a narrow beam of consciousness. For a while, I thought everything was about faith, and I think it is all about faith, but I think everything is about everything. You know, we can call that love, we can call that faith, we can call that courage, we can call that wisdom. All of those paths, all of those openings, all of those ways of understanding lead us to those kinds of strength that are not things we hold in a solitary kind of fashion so that we're alone and strong, but the kinds of strength that lead us to a much greater sense of being with one another, of taking care of one another. The kinds of insights I'm most interested in are the ones that lead to a change in consciousness or a change in our being that becomes very natural. It's not something contrived or put upon or assumed in some way. When His Holiness the Dalai Lama I'm told you're not supposed to say won the Nobel Peace Prize. When he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and you're also not supposed to say a Nobel Peace Prize winner, you're supposed to say a Nobel Peace Prize recipient. So when he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, one of my friends said, giving the Dalai Lama a Peace Prize is like giving Mother Nature an art award. You know, and I really like that. You know, not kind of an assumption of a persona with maybe a little bit of smugness or self-righteousness, like, hey, I'm really great, you know, I'm so compassionate, I'm so peaceful. But what's it like when we just become what we know to be true, when the natural expression of our understanding is being manifest? That's the kind of insight that I find really compelling. And that's the kind of insight I really believe is available to each of us. We don't have to assume a kind of narrow vision of what spiritual life would look like or who we must be, even though we don't really want to, or how we have to pretend, because really we're not capable and we have to act like we are. It's not that at all. It's about coming to those strengths that we genuinely do have inside, each of us, inevitably, whether we believe it or not. And through the force of our insight, our understanding, having our lives change in a way that is completely natural. That's what I had to say. Do you have any questions? Anything you'd like to talk about? Sure. The question was about this being her first time here and wanting an introductory explanation of what this is all about. I can't really tell you what this group is all about, but I think somebody will at the end. The practice that is the basis of this kind of meditation is called insight meditation. It's the I and the Sims and the I and the Insight Meditation Society. The practice was founded in the Buddhist tradition, and Thank you. It was a dramatic night in the elements. It's getting warmer, though. I'm about to take off my coat. And particularly in the kind of Buddhism that was preserved in Southeast Asia, in Burma and Thailand, which is Theravada Buddhism. And one of the characteristics of that school, of the Buddhist teaching, is that the Buddha is represented as having been a human being. And it is said that it's said he asked many questions about life. In effect, he said, what does it mean to be born in a human body and to be so vulnerable, so helpless, so subject to conditions around, and then to grow up and to grow old and to get sick and to die, whether we like that or not? And is there a kind of happiness that can be found that isn't going to be broken when the body goes through these changes? And what does it mean to have a human mind that is so changing? You know, we wake up in the morning, we're filled with faith, and then it's doubt, and then it's fear, and then it's joy, and then this cascade of feelings outside of our personal control. And again, you know, he said, in effect, is there a kind of happiness that won't shatter, that isn't going to be so variable as these moods change, as these emotions change? And it said that the answers he came to, or the resolutions he came to through the power of his own awareness. And just as he could answer his fundamental questions about the nature of life and happiness, so can we, whatever our questions happen to be, through the power of our own awareness. And so the practices, the meditation practices, are centered around the cultivation of concentration and awareness, loving kindness, compassion, all of those qualities which are said to bring us to that kind of insight into the nature of our lives. And so it's also said that the Buddha is very famous for having said, don't believe anything just because I say it, or because a great elder has said it, or because you've read it in a sacred text. He said, put it into practice and see for yourself if it's true. So these kinds of groups around this kind of practice don't, generally speaking, talk about becoming a Buddhist in any way. You know, it's really not a question of adopting a dogma or a set of beliefs. It's about using certain tools to see for ourselves what might be so. In fact, it's funny being here in the temple. There was one period when I had gone to Nepal to practice meditation with a group of friends, and then Thailand on the way home. And this was right after the Gulf War, and security was very tight in the airports for that time. And we were in Thailand, and for some reason, I have no idea why, we were pulled aside, this group, Joseph Goldstein and I and a few friends, pulled aside for extra special security. And so they asked us all these questions, like, where were you last night and what did you do? And then at one point, the man looked at me and he said, are you Jewish? And having been born and brought up Jewish, I said, yes. And he just let us through. And then maybe a few minutes later, we were at the place where our hand baggage was going to get screened. And so we put the stuff on the rolling table, and we had bought a number of Buddha statues in Nepal. And so there were all the Buddha statues illuminated on the screen, you know. And so the woman there looked at me and said, are you Buddhist? And I said, yes. And I walked on through. And then I was sitting on the airplane, and I thought, that's really weird, you know. That's the most condensed period of my life, when I was twice asked my religious affiliation. I gave two different answers. You know, it's just a couple of minutes. But really, you know, we don't emphasize becoming a Buddhist or even thinking in those terms, but looking at these skills and trying them out, putting them into practice, seeing what happens. And that's really what it's about.
faith isn't one of the words that comes to mind. More other words come to mind, and faith comes into practice more when I think about how I grew up, or actually how I believe now, which is in a faith person. But how do you talk about faith in the vehicle?
Mm-hmm. The question was about when she thinks of Buddhism, the word faith isn't what comes to mind. I know. In fact, I met that kind of question a lot in the process of writing the book. And the word in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, is sadda. In Sanskrit, it's Shraddha, and it literally means to place your heart upon, to offer your heart. And it's very much intrinsic to taking something that is abstract and making it real for oneself. That's mostly how I think of faith. You know, if we hear that the Buddha was enlightened sitting under the tree, well, that's all well and good. But what is it that happens in our hearts that says, what can happen for me, you know, for my life, my transformation? There's something that happens that is faith that we need. We need to take that which is abstract, remote, belonging to someone else, and feel included rather than excluded from a sense of possibility. We need to move right into the center of change and seize that possibility for ourselves rather than feeling where we're cut off or we're apart from what can be. You know, that's what faith is really about. It's that movement right to the center of possibility. And really, we don't do anything without some kind of faith. Because in the way, especially in Buddhist tradition, where doubt and questioning and wondering and evaluating and investigating aren't antithetical to faith, they really strengthen our faith, then the real opposite of faith is despair. You know, when we feel quite cut off from that sense of possibility, we feel really severed from a bigger picture of life. We feel disconnected. And so to not be in a state of despair, really, we have some kind of faith going on. When I was once in Burma with my Burmese meditation teacher, whose name is Sayadaw Upandita, I talked about him a little bit this weekend, who's very demanding, fierce, intense kind of teacher. And the program in Burma, in the monastery, as Rodney will remember very well, is very strict. You have the schedule reads like 4 hours of sleep a night. You don't have any food after lunch, which happens to be served at 10 in the morning. And it's very, very intense. And there's a teaching in Buddhism about these five spiritual qualities, which when developed strongly become five spiritual powers. And these are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So one day we're sitting with Upandita and he said to me, which of these five, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, is the most important? So I figured, you know, he's so demanding, he's so intense, things are so challenging there, I'd say energy or effort. So I said, effort. And he said, no. And then I thought, well, this is like the homeland of mindfulness. You know, this is like everything taught there is based on this one sutta, one teaching of the Buddha's, the Satipatthana Sutta, which is about mindfulness. The whole meditation practice centers around mindfulness. I'm in like the homeland of mindfulness. So having been wrong the first time, I said, mindfulness. And he said, no. So I said, well, what is it? He said, faith. Because without the faith, we hear about mindfulness and we think that's nice. You know, or we are discussing or admiring the quality of effort or energy, but we think it's about somebody else and not about us. It's faith that, as the Buddha said, is the beginning of all good things, because it's what moves us to actually put something into practice and see for ourselves if it's true. So it's right in there. Now the question was, in the West we often think about faith in something, and could I speak a little bit more about how faith functions? I think also from the Buddhist point of view we can think of faith in something, but we don't have to. If we're thinking about faith in something, it's traditionally the Buddha, the Dharma, his teachings, the Sangha, the community of those who have accomplished realization through those teachings. But what that comes down to essentially is faith in ourselves. You know, when we look at the Buddha, for example, he was a human being who, it is said, through the power of his own awareness, came to this kind of realization and freedom of mind, so that he wasn't afraid, he wasn't confused, he wasn't filled with attachment. He had a free mind which translated into boundless compassion. But when we look at the Buddha, it's not about looking at the Buddha. It's about, it's almost like looking right through the Buddha at ourselves, because the Buddha is representing who each of us can be without exception. You know, so sometimes I think of it as like looking at a transparency. We look at the Buddha to see ourselves, but we look at ourselves not to say, hey, I'm great, you know. And no one else is. We look at ourselves on that level, on our deepest human potential, to see everybody. So we look at the Buddha, or we have faith in the Buddha to have faith in ourselves, and we have faith in ourselves to have faith in all beings, in this capacity to be free, which we all share. So, and the Dharma is the same. You know, the teachings exist not to be like a monument, but really as a way of turning us each back to those strengths and nurturing them. And the Sangha is the same. You know, we look at the community of those who've walked the path before us and accomplished realization, because that means we can too. So, you know, ultimately what we have faith in, from the Buddhist point of view, is our Buddha nature, and in the fact that that is shared by all beings. Or you could talk about faith just as a process of the heart. It's really, it is the ability to recognize that tomorrow doesn't have to look like today, and the self-image we've been carrying doesn't have to prevail, and the ways we have felt imprisoned or shut down or held down don't have to endure. You know, once we recognize that things change, then we can have faith, because then there will be a sense of possibility. There will be a sense of movement, even if we don't know where things are going. Just to know that nothing is solid, nothing is enduring. Everything changes, and we can move toward that change. You know, early on in my book, and I must have told this story when I was here in August, but early on in my book, I tell the story about I was having a conversation with a psychiatrist once in New York City, who we were talking about what might be considered the single most healing element in the psychotherapeutic relationship, which is very funny now looking back, because it seems so reductionistic, like how silly to think there's just one. But anyway, that's what we're talking about. And so we're talking about what might be considered the single most healing element in the psychotherapeutic relationship. And we talked about methodology and systems and so on. And at one point, he looked at me and he said, if you put any good psychotherapist up against the wall, they'd be forced to admit that it's love. It's the love in the room that is the single most healing element. And I had one of those experiences, you know, where you just hear these words come out of your mouth and you think, where did that come from? And what I heard come out of my mouth was, well, for all we know, the single most healing element in the psychotherapeutic relationship is the fact that the person showed up for their appointment. And even though it was like a complete blurt, I realized, you know, there's some truth in that. There's something that got that person out of bed, or gets that person out of bed, gets them to show up, gets them to take a risk, gets them to try, gets them to have that sense of possibility, that's faith. And then my book came out on August 5th, which happened to be my birthday, and the psychiatrist came to the reading. So I told that story in his honor. And he came up to me at the end with his book to be signed, and he looked at me and he said, "You're wrong, it's love." So then he came to my birthday party afterwards, and maybe 2 hours into the party, he came up to me and he said, "I've been thinking about it all night, and you're right." When he'd come up to me earlier at the bookstore, after he said, "It's love," I took his book and I wrote, "It's love," in these giant letters, exclamation point, exclamation point. So then when he said, "I'm wrong, you're right, it's faith," I said, "Well, give me back the book." But part of the reason I'm so interested in that is that I think, and of course it's not just one thing, but it is faith, and it is our own faith, and it is the capacity of our own hearts, and that is something we don't often honor. We don't often give ourselves enough credit for that movement of the heart that says, "I'm going to go forward. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not going to pretend I know what's going to happen. And still I'm going to go forward. I'm going to meet this situation. I'm going to see what happens with that kind of in that kind of open-hearted way." And I think that's a huge strength we have, that because we don't honor it so much, we also don't cultivate it as much as we might. And amongst the many reasons I decided to write the book, that was one, you know. And it was a peculiar choice of topic. But that was one reason, you know, is because I really feel very strongly about that. Yeah. The question was about for those who are around the suffering of innocent beings like animals or people in the developing world, how does faith bear upon the kind of anger one feels? Well, another thing we have faith in, if we have that kind of vision of life, is a sense of the interconnectedness, which is it's like the truth of our existence, that all of us live in a web of conditions, of connections, that is the fabric of life itself, so that no one is actually cut off or alone or separate, however separate we might feel, or we might regard others really as other. The truth underlying all of that is that we are inextricably interconnected. And I think if in Buddhism anything were to kind of be the equivalent of what in other traditions might be a kind of transcendent dimension, it is that sense of interconnection. It's of life itself, which is huge. And we are all a part of it, no one alone. And because of that, often, that vision or that faith, when we take action to try to help or to make a difference, even though we might feel helpless, or we might feel like we can't do enough, or we might feel that nothing's working, it's not making a difference, that we're ineffectual, the faith really comes from that belief or that idea that what we do is rippling out, even if we can't always see the result, we can't always see the consequence of that. And I also tell a story in the book about an experience I had, which was very, very transforming for me in just this light. It's a little complicated. It's got a lot of different levels to it, but when his Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Upandita, first came to the States, it was 1984, and he came to teach a retreat in Barrie at the retreat center I co-founded, and we had a really fantastic translator for that three-month period. So somebody came to me at the end of that time and said, wouldn't it be great to make a book out of his talks? And so I did, you know, I helped create this book, and it was a nice thing to do, and I kind of thought, oh, that's sweet enough, you know, and forgot about it. And then years later I heard that this woman named Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the leader of the democracy movement in Burma, had come upon this book and had used it to teach herself how to meditate in her years of house arrest, so that there was a period when she was freed from house arrest, and she is really the hope of the Burmese people for democracy, and has stayed in Burma suffering many, many things, including you know, not seeing her husband for many years, not seeing her children for many years, and then finally, this was after this story, but, you know, her husband was very sick with cancer in England, and they wouldn't give him a visa to go back into Burma, so he ended up dying without her ever seeing him again. So, you know, it was an enormous tragedy and sacrifice in her decision not to leave Burma, but to stay and work for democracy. And so when there was some period when a lot of restrictions were lifted from her life, and she said that when she got that book, she used it to teach herself how to meditate, and the book was really the major source of spiritual strength for her in her years of house arrest. You know, so then I looked back at my rather dismissive attitude toward having helped create the book, and I thought, ooh, look at that. You know, I really felt, I decided at that point, I said I was going to someday write a book called Basically Clueless, you know, because it's like, I really believe we are, you know, and that we have to do absolutely the best we can. We have to do the good that's in front of us, whatever it is, even if it seems like nothing, if it seems like just a little bit, that we have to go for it, because we don't know how it's going to ripple out, where it's going to go, who it's going to affect, or when. And that way, I think we have a steadier, more sustainable motivation for action than anger will probably give us, you know, because it's so hard to sustain action when anger is the motivation, because we just get burnt up by the anger ourselves, you know, and depleted. Hi.
Could you talk a little about your practice now and what it looks like?
My meditation practice. My meditation practice now and what it looks like. Well, a lot of times in my practice I kind of go back to the basics. There was a period in the 80s, the late 80s, I've been practicing for over 30 years now, you know, so it's looked a lot of different ways at different times, but I went to Burma in 1985. And began doing intensive loving kindness practice, which I did for about 4 years. Before then, I was doing, you know, awareness of the breath, the body, basic mindfulness practice, largely. And for that 4 year period, I decided I wanted to devote myself to the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion and those qualities, and so that's really what I did. And after those 4 years, I went back largely to doing an awareness practice. And sometimes I just sit and I feel my breath, you know? It's like back to lesson one. I like that. Often I do loving kindness practice now in an informal way, like walking down the street in New York, standing in line at the grocery store, always on an airplane or a bus or something like that. So I try to bring it to life in a lot of what I do during the day. I think practice can be, you can do a very simple practice, like feeling the breath, and notice very profound changes over time. You know, it doesn't have to be an elaborate practice. It's fine. Yeah. Faith is a muscle?
Yeah.
Okay, so the comment was about saying that faith is a muscle. If you exercise it, it'll get stronger over time. So what can we expect over time? Well, in the Buddhist teaching, there's a kind of architecture of faith that begins with what is called bright faith, which is likened to falling in love, when we have a kind of dazzling sense of new possibility. Maybe it's the feeling like we've been sitting in a dark and closed room with the door shut and feeling confined and constrained, and then the door swings open and we think, wow, my life really can be different. And it's often incredibly exciting and exultant, and it's like falling in love. It's this amazing feeling, and so that's often the beginning. And that's great, actually. It's a huge help to move us out of the habits and the fears and the ruts we may be in, to be willing to explore and be willing to step away from the convenient or the familiar. So it's a great strength. But it's also very fragile. It's very vulnerable, that kind of faith, because for one thing, it's dependent on someone else. You know, it happens when we meet a teacher or we read something or we experience something external. It opens us up. And, so we might meet one teacher one day and he or she says, live this way. And we think, yeah, I'm going to live this way. It's incredible. And then we meet another teacher another day and they say, well, live that way. And we think, yeah, forget that other guy. You know, I'm going to live this way. And it's not really grounded or centered in our own vision of what is true. And the other problem with it is that feeling of exaltation can be so extraordinary. It's like being intoxicated, that we don't want to rock the boat by doing anything that might distance us from what seems to be the source of that amazing feeling, which is somebody else. And so we might become afraid to ask questions, or we don't want to express our uncertainty or point out problems we might see, you know, because we just don't want to threaten anything. And so it's a very immature kind of faith. And the next stage of faith is called verified faith, where our vision of what is true is grounded in our own experience, our own sense. And the path, interestingly enough, from bright faith to verified faith is a path of doubt. It means put everything into practice. Check everything out. Ask every question. You know, keep exploring. Keep demanding to know the truth for yourself. Investigate. It's based on the feeling that we have both the right and the ability to know the truth for ourselves. And so we have to verify. We have to really look critically at everything, and that's important. And when we do that enough about something, the third stage of faith that's talked about is something called abiding faith or unwavering faith. And that's when we really have the kind of faith where we've checked something out so thoroughly, we really know it so deeply, then it's kind of like what I meant by the Dalai Lama. You know, it's not something we proclaim to the world anymore. It's just who we are. And then I think things are very, or our being is kind of simple. You know, it's not a lot of ideas or proclamations or holding on to beliefs. It's really very simple. I mean, I was once at an interfaith conference with the Dalai Lama, and it was a Buddhist Christian conference, and at the end of it, somebody stood up and said, you know, they made a point of saying that actually, I'll tell you two Dalai Lama stories about that conference. This is what I mean by simplicity of being. He got there, this is at Gethsemane Monastery in Kentucky, where Thomas Merton had lived, and the Dalai Lama had gotten there a day early and had been given a tour of the monastery, which supported itself through the manufacturing of cheese and fruitcake. And the Dalai Lama gave the opening address, and it was a rather solemn occasion. You know, here we were in Thomas Merton's monastery, and it was a very small group of people, and a lot of dignitaries from both religions, and it was also being televised for PBS, so there were these TV cameras going, and the Dalai Lama was speaking and marking the occasion, and then he segues into talking about his tour, and he said, oh, you know, I had a wonderful time taking this tour, and I was so pleased when they offered me a piece of cheese, but what I really wanted was a piece of fruitcake. And he started laughing, and he said, it's so unfortunate, nobody gave me any fruitcake. You know, I really wanted some fruitcake. And he's just carrying on in front of all these people and a television audience about wanting a piece of fruitcake. And I leaned over and I said to a bishop, do you think you could get him a piece of fruitcake? You know, but it was so charming because it was so, like, kind of childlike. It wasn't like, well, I'm the Dalai Lama and I can't want anything, you know. And even though I really did, I have to act like I don't, you know. And like, you know, it was just kind of out there. That's sort of the feeling. So then at the end of the conference, somebody made a point of saying, whenever the Dalai Lama spoke, he would begin his sentence by saying, from the Buddhist point of view, it is. Or if he was talking about a particular philosophical school, he'd say, from the Majjhimaka point of view, it is. But most speakers, when they got up, would basically say, it is. You know, and I thought that was another example of another kind of faith, where it's not a declaration of belief, and it's not an insistence that other people see it the same way. It's just like this very simple heart's presentation. You can afford, when you have that kind of faith, to say, from the Buddha's point of view, it is. Because you're not needing to convince anybody. You know, and it's not like a weapon or something that you're forcing on anybody else. It's just, okay, here it is. And so that's sort of the nature of abiding faith. And we develop it in many things, you know. I can't see a thing. Yeah. Okay, the question was about the other side of changeability, which is kind of insecurity and brings up a lot of fear, like the roller coaster nature of one's mind and changing attachments and friendships and coming up against the Western notion of meaning, which she associates with duration, right, and constancy, some kind of constancy. Well, actually, I would say that from the Buddhist point of view, that sense of meaning comes not from constancy and duration because they are not real, but more from the kind of interconnectedness that I was talking about before. That the meaning is meaningfulness. It's understanding our actions are consequential, that one thing leads to the next, that we're not alone, any of us, that we exist in this fabric of connection, that that's really the truth of things. And that's where the sense of meaning, I think, as you're implying, comes from. You know, that it's not, nothing we do is inconsequential. It's not meaningless. It's not random. Life is part of, our lives are part of this greater whole. And in fact, one of the great quotations that has meant a lot to me is this line from Rilke, where he says something like, "Do not be frightened if a sadness greater than you've ever known before rises up in front of you. Life has not forgotten you." You know, it's that sense of connection, that life has not forgotten us. We're not abandoned. We're not apart, no matter what our experience is. That's the end of despair. That's the movement into faith. Changeability, you're right, of course. You know, it has all of that sense of loss and elusiveness and not being able to grasp onto things, not being able to make them last, not being able to make people constant, you know, or unchanging. We suffer from that. You know, there's a lot of genuine suffering when we try to demand that not be so. The other side of change is a kind of freedom, you know, because if, say, we experience a painful sensation in the body or an illness or a heartache or a difficult situation, and we experience it as unchanging, unyielding, impermeable, solid, then we're stuck. And we feel stuck, you know, we feel oppressed. It's an unbearable feeling. But if we can find the change within it, then something opens. And even though what we're seeing is unpleasant, you know, it's still painful, we're seeing that it comes and goes. We're seeing that it's not sustained all the time. We're seeing that in movement, there are shadings of intensity. There are different things going on. It's not just one thing, you know. It's not just loss, for example. It's also fear. It's also avoidance. It's also this. It's also that. And so as we enter that world of change, it's like things open up. It's more vibrant. It's more real. And there is a sense of possibility. You know how we are. We like to think we know what's going to happen all the time, and that we're in control, that we're on top of things. And it's just not so. And we need to find a way to go forward, to meet the circumstance of life, admitting that we're not going to be in control. So what draws us to come forward, to have that kind of courage, is the recognition that everything changes, that there's movement in there, in that situation. We don't know what it is, and we don't know what it's going to yield, and we don't know what will come next, but still we can go forward, because we can enter that. There's some place to enter. There's some space there. Yeah.
I think that you're really listening, and in a room like this, that must be very difficult. There's so much input, and I just wonder how you stay connected to the person that's talking to you at the same time there's so much else going on.
Yeah, well, thank you. The question was. That I seem to, it's just funny because I am really, my memory is not what it once was, so really, names are kind of gone. The question was about my ability to seemingly repeat a question almost verbatim, and the kind of connection that must imply in a room such as this where there's so much information and stimulation going on, and the comment about listening. And I mean, I think the listening, thank you, really. I think the listening is also something that's strongly cultivated in meditation practice, that is part of what happens. You know, we're so quick usually to respond and react, and we hardly listen to one another anyway. You know, mostly a few words are out of somebody's mouth and we're thinking, what am I going to say? You know, and how's it going to sound? Is it going to sound okay? That I think listening is a skill, you know, that we are sorely lacking, obviously, in our society, and that maybe now more than ever we have got to start listening to one another. And so I think meditation is a profound way of learning that skill. And I'd also say that some of my being able to do that is really from the role. And I just had this funny experience not too long ago where I was in New York City and two of my friends were speaking that evening, Joseph Goldstein and Mark Epstein, who's a psychiatrist, not the psychiatrist in New York City that I had the conversation with, but a different one. And they were sharing an evening presentation. And when the questions came, I would sit there as they were being asked, and I think, what would I say to that? You know, I don't know what I would say to that. Or, and I realized that if I were the one sitting up there, I wouldn't be going through all that. I would just be listening. But because I was sitting in the audience, I did all that. So then when it was over, I went up to Mark and I said, I just had a very strong glimpse of ego creation. You know, that. But that's mostly how we are, is that we're not really listening. We're trying to figure out what would be a, you know, a stellar response that that everyone would take note of and, you know, talk about for weeks afterwards or something like that. And really, we'd do better just to listen. Yeah?
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit
Mm-hmm. The question was about reconciling our kind of faith in our connection to the divine or divine presence with what is essentially a non-theistic kind of practice. And that's sort of what I meant before when I said that in the Buddhist tradition, probably the closest to that sense of divinity or divine presence is that sense of vast interconnection, which takes us out of our limited and confined sense of who we are and just opens us in a very different way. So like one example would be, or from the in the Buddhist tradition, we might talk about relative and absolute truth simultaneously existing and informing one another. They're not sort of like two separate mountaintops, you know, that never meet. We find the relative in the absolute and the absolute in the relative. And an example I sometimes use is we started the center in 1976, and when it came time for our 20th anniversary, we decided to have a party, which we had in the summer, and it involved the planting of a tree in the garden at IMS. And we have one course every year for teenagers called the Young Adults course, and so some of the young adults planted the tree in the garden. And so now you can go down into the garden at IMS and see the tree, and on one level it's just a tree. You know, you just see this seemingly solid, singular entity that's the tree. But on another level you can look at the tree and sense the earth, which has nurtured it, and all the people through all the centuries who have stewarded that piece of earth, that plot of land, that is also part of the tree. And you can sense the rainfall and the quality of the rainfall and everything that affects the quality of that rainfall, which is basically everything, you know, in the universe. And you can sense the air and the moonlight and the sunlight, and you know, you could look at that tree and get a feeling for the organization, which at that point was 20 years old, is now almost 27 years old, and what it means, the organization and all of that. Sometimes I say, you know, I go down in the garden, I look at the tree, and I see meetings. I see staff meetings and board meetings and teacher meetings and these meetings and that meetings. You know, that's also part of that organization. That's the tree. And you know, what is it? You can look at the tree and also get a sense of that teenager who planted it. You know, what was it that brought somebody at that young an age to want to learn how to meditate. You know, that's also implicit there in the existence of the tree. So there's a way of going down to the garden and seeing just a tree, or there's a way of going down to the garden and seeing a much bigger sense of connections and relationships and influences and interactions, and you can see all of life in that tree. And so that's the kind of perception that I think would be the living experience of like an absolute truth of that vast interconnection right here and now. Yeah.
Are you troubled by the tremendous suffering in the world, and is there practice related to that?
Am I troubled by the tremendous suffering in the world? Does my practice relate to that? Yeah, I'm very troubled by the tremendous suffering in the world. And I think some of my practice has allowed me to see it without being so afraid, or allows me, I shouldn't say it in past tense, you know, allows me to see it more and more without being so afraid to face it. And part of it teaches me to be more honest in that same vein, you know, so that I don't feel what has been my conditioning really all my life, or early life, you know, which was to call it something else or look the other way, or, you know, not admit it. And I also feel that, again, using the example of the Dalai Lama, you know, that there's a resiliency and a strength of mind, not a rigid strength, but a kind of open strength or flexible strength that's important in seeing the suffering, so that one is not broken by it. Otherwise, there's nothing you can do about it, you know, or try to do about it, because it's just too much. And so even though it seems paradoxical a lot, you know, and it's hard for words to convey it, I think that the kind of sense of balance or peace or equanimity that my practice gives me doesn't pull me away from that, from what is revealed, you know, in seeing the world more clearly and the suffering of the world, but it gives me some ability to hang in there more. There's a time in 1979 when those of us who were at IMS at our center invited the Dalai Lama to come. And we were very young, and we had that habit of inviting these really eminent people and shooting off these letters and thinking, yeah, they'll never come, you know, and then sometimes they'd come. And he came, and we got this letter saying he was coming. And the center is on, it's about 2.5 miles outside of the town of Barrie on this road called Pleasant Street, and we had to blockade Pleasant Street. And even though security then was nothing like it is now, still it was very intense for us. So we had these state troopers patrolling the roofs with guns, and it was this enormous, wild scene for us for his visit. And just before he'd come, I had been in a car accident, and I'd broken a bone in one of my feet, and I was using crutches, which I was not very good at. So the day came that he was coming, and I was standing way in the back of like 100 people, feeling very sorry for myself, and very morose, and I was thinking, you know, here I am way in the back, and I co-founded the center, and I'm stuck way in the back, you know, and I'm such a klutz, you know, it's like, I'm terrible. If I dare to go up front, I'd probably trip and fall on my face in front of him, and that'd be even worse, I'd better stay in the back. His car pulled up in the midst of this very zooey scene, you know, all this stuff going on, and he did something I've seen him do many times since, but it was the first time I'd ever seen him do it, which was that he seems to have a kind of radar for who in a room might be suffering the most, and that was me. It's like, looking back, I don't even remember him having the time to visually scan or anything like that. It seemed like in one motion, he got out of the car, he cut through about 100 people, he came up to me, he took my hand, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, "What happened?" And it's been, for me, a kind of new definition of compassion ever since that moment, because I realized there was nothing he could do to make my injury not have occurred, and there was nothing he could do to make me more skillful in the use of the crutches, but that terrible isolating feeling of being so alone and so unseen and so uncared for, he made that go away in a moment, in a gesture. And I think that that's what I hold as my kind of image of compassion, whether or not we can make the suffering go away, whether or not we can, recreate the world as we want it to be. I don't think anybody should suffer with that feeling of being alone and unseen on top of everything else. And so that is really my effort. You know, and that's why I think the balance or the strength of the practice is really important, to be able to continue to go forth and know that I can't make it all go away. I think we have to stop, right? Yeah. Thank you.